Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I am your host, Chad Wesley Smith, joined as always, marvelous Max Montana. How you doing, buddy?
Doing pretty well. How are you doing?
Good. We are both high on Thunder King coffee right now.
This is being filmed at 4 a.m.
I've recently installed a kegerator of nitro cold brew coffee into my home, and it is being overused, most likely. But today, we're going to talk about peaking, and our sponsor for today's episode is Chick-fil-A and Adaptive Decay. It's a lifestyle. It's so appropriate that that company approached us for this specific episode.
They're a new lifestyle brand. They really market heavily to the Chick-fil-A, obviously. a lot of their stands are shirts and apparel is in the Chick-fil-A office. What do you think the best Chick-fil-A sandwich is? The chicken one?
The chicken. I am partial to the chicken ones.
I enjoy their chicken. They do chicken. They do a bang up job with it.
Yeah, did they invent the chicken sandwich? No, I think they just perfected it. I can't remember.
They perfected it.
Yeah, but the chicken egg and cheese biscuit.
No idea what they served. I thought it was all fried chicken until I actually went there and experienced the glorious, delicious chicken sandwiches they have.
Yeah, I mean, the fried chicken sandwiches are obviously better.
Yeah,
than
the grilled ones are when you're ashamed of yourself.
Yeah, sometimes when you're ashamed of yourself, you order broccoli, but then you come to terms. with the reality of
it. The regret of ordering broccoli quickly subsides when you switch for the French fries. It's such a good experience.
Yeah. All right, back to the topic at hand. Peaking. What is it? All right, peaking is a process of optimizing the fitness-fatigue relationship for the one day that matters, the day of the competition on the platform with the three judges watching, not the week before, not the day after, not in the training hall while the competition's going alongside of it. No, the one day that matters, and it's physiological, it's psychological. A lot of different factors at play, and we're going to talk about the differences and similarities between peaking for powerlifting and peaking for weightlifting.
Yep.
So some of the goals of peaking, and this holds true for both sports, are about neural adaptations. When you're lifting the heaviest weight possible, of course, muscular systems are hugely important in that, but for those absolute limit weights, the neurological adaptations become paramount. And then developing technical prowess is going to be the goal of peaking training. So the skill of the one rep max. And then, as we mentioned, managing that fitness fatigue relationship so that on that one shining, glorious day of competition, you feel as good as you can, but not so well rested that you've lost some of the fitness that you've worked so hard for in the previous weeks and months.
Yeah, basically the essence of peaking is planning, is proper planning. We want to have the best possible performance at the meet that we can. We're going to achieve that by planning our training properly. All these factors come into play, you know, that Chad's talking about in terms of muscular side, neurological side, you know, fitness decaying, fatigue decaying. Appropriate planning is the essence of peaking, right?
Yes. Moisture is the essence of beauty. Yeah. So in regards to the planning, I think it's important to note that proper peaking, everyone's going to think that we're actually high, not just high on the coffee.
I keep walking by it. I have filled this up three times today with iced coffee. Dangerous combination.
Yeah,
because
it's not a easy.
You walk by coffee. It and you're like, I feel good, and this is delicious. Thunder King, thank you.
This is the thing making me feel good.
This is me.
but yeah, in regards to the idea of planning, good peaking starts long before the meet. It starts long before the peaking block itself, and certainly long before just the taper. Though we will just be talking about the specifically peaking. You know, we have plenty of other resources where we discuss the more general training for powerlifting, weightlifting, hypertrophy for powerlifting, general training for weightlifting, as well as general strength training for both sports. So we talked about the goals, neural adaptations, technical prowess, managing fitness, fatigue. How are those goals achieved? Real quick, kind of big picture look at those. Neural adaptations are going to be best achieved by lifting very heavy weights, weights at above 90% of the one rep maximum. You can't go into a competition, you know, as important as submaximal training is, and as much as you know, Max and I have touted the value of higher volumes of work in those mid ranges, you can't expect to go to the competition without having touched those 90% plus weights and be as successful as possible. Developing technical prowess, that is going to be highly dependent on highly specific training. The competition lifts loaded appropriately, so loaded, you know, with 90% plus for singles. If you're trying to get good at singles, you're going to have to do some singles, a couple doubles here and there, a couple triples as well, but the highest specificity possible, the closer and closer you get to competition. Along with that, in regards to technique, technical sessions, lighter sessions, are going to become very important because the technical SRA curve, stimulus recovery adaptation, again, a fancy way for me to sound smarter than I am by using big words that I stole from Dr. Mike, but the technical SRA curve is very short, meaning that when you can develop technique, you know, rather quickly, but you can also lose it very quickly if you don't give yourself frequent enough exposure to that. And because the two sort of work opposing to each other of lifting really heavy weights and training very frequently, you'll probably need to use some light technical sessions to help fully develop that technical prowess that we're looking for. And that goes right into the third point of managing fitness fatigue, and that is going to be achieved through less frequent overloading. Please refer to our video, Scientific Principles of Strength Training, Principle of Overload video, to learn more about that. But it's really just less frequent hard training within the parameters that are going to develop, you know, these peaking qualities that we mentioned. With that, with the less frequent overloading, and in the effort, in the vein of managing fitness fatigue, it's going to be about lower volume. And then finally, the taper, the icing on the cake at the end of the great peak, which is going to perfect that fitness fatigue relationship. Just
the salt bay. Yeah,
the salt bay of it. So let's get into some ideas about the differences in peaking for athletes between powerlifting and weightlifting, and some of their practical implications. So for powerlifting, you know, some of the key differences compared to weightlifting is, one, how much weight is on the bar. Hopefully, powerlifters have more weight on the bar than weightlifters.
You should be squatting more than other people snatch.
Yes. And of course, we're talking about lifters of comparable qualification across the two sports. But the heavier weights in powerlifting mean more fatigue is being generated. Also, the lack of an eccentric phase in the weightlifting movements, a lot of fatigue and muscular damage occurs there. But since you just, you know, drop a snatch or a clean and jerk from the top, you're not lowering it under control, there's not quite as much fatigue generated from that. And then the other kind of big point with it is the intricacy of the technique. I think weightlifting technique, and we've talked about this a lot, is more intricate, is more nuanced than powerlifting technique. It needs and requires more frequent exposure. Otherwise, you're going to get rusty, you know, for lack of a better term. But you're going to move away from that technical prowess, which is so high on our priority list. So, what are some of the practical implications of that, Max? As far as knowing powerlifting is heavier weights, which generates more fatigue, knowing that weightlifting has more intricate technique, how does that manifest itself in differences in the peaking strategy?
Again, it's very similar. The process is the same. It's just that we see a manifestation of those things in a different way. So in powerlifting, where you have really, really heavy weights done less frequently, the same thing is true in weightlifting. It's just that frequency is different. If you squat 800 pounds, you're not going to squat 800 pounds two or three times in a week. But if you clean and jerk, let's say comparable amount, you clean and jerk 200 kilos, you may be able to do that at the frequency of, you know, twice a week or something. So the recovery time is going to be shorter for those weightlifting movements, just simply because the absolute weight on the bar is less. With the technical skill, the technical requirements of weightlifting being so much higher, you're going to have to perform the movement more frequently. And because of that, you're going to need to have more sessions during the peaking phase that establish technique and keep the skill present in the lifter's mind and in kind of in the lifter's body. So you have more lighter sessions of technique practiced more frequently. And then with the shorter recovery time between sessions, you can have more heavy sessions leading up to that. So you're going to increase weights lifted over 90%. They're going to be more frequent than in powerlifting. In powerlifting, you might have several sessions in the month, two or three sessions in the month that go above 90% in that final peak. In weightlifting, you might have six or seven. So really, it's related to the weight on the bar, the lack of eccentric, and then just the generally faster recovery time from those things or from the lighter weight.
Okay. The other big difference, and again, speaking in generalities, and we're talking about athletes of similar qualification across the two sports, is that you're going to see longer taper periods for powerlifting compared to weightlifting. And I think that the easiest way to almost visualize this concept is if you've been to big powerlifting meets and you've been to big weightlifting meets, the big difference in what they have there is that the weightlifting meets have a training hall.
Right.
And the powerlifting meets do not. Because the weightlifters, it is so imperative that they are training fairly hard, you know, up to the competition. That's why you see so much of this cool, you know, hook grip and all things gym footage is coming from the training hall, you know, really badass lifts that are a week out, you know, 5 days out, 3 days out. So you're going to have that shorter taper for weightlifting at relatively higher intensities because in weightlifting, I think it's trained the lifts certainly at relative higher intensities the whole way, because trying to do a clean with 60% is just so much
irrelevant
different.
Almost. Yeah. The other thing too, is that throughout the, with the difference between powerlifting and weightlifting is that powerlifting, we could say, has more physicality to it in that it's better that a lifter is peaked on the physical side of the equation than on the technical side. If they miss some technical sessions going into a competition, they're probably going to walk up and be like, I don't know how to squat anymore. Whereas with weightlifting,
the target you're shooting at is a little bit bigger.
Right. In weightlifting, you're in a better position to be slightly less ready physically if you had to do more sessions to refine the technique and establish that your technique is at the highest level it can be, because the technique is so much more significant to success in the sport. If you're off a little bit technically, you can miss a lift, even though you're physically capable of it. So there's always going to be, in the peaking for weightlifting, a skewed training volume towards technical practice, whereas in powerlifting, it's always going to be skewed a little bit more towards fatigue decay, I would say.
So one of the real magic parts, let's say, of a good weightlifting taper is how the squat is used for weightlifting. Right. And, you know, we talk about squats with weightlifting a lot because they are very integral to success, but they are not the sport. So as we talk about technical prowess and neural adaptations and managing fitness fatigue and doing the most specific training possible, well, the most specific training possible for weightlifting by definition would not include squatting.
Right.
But actually, you know, from a practical sense, maximizing performance, of course, does include squatting. So how do you approach the loading and training of the squat leading up to competition?
So assuming the squatting has been going the entire training cycle the way we normally would approach it, which is obviously higher volumes, higher repetitions per set earlier in the training cycle, in the peaking phase, our main goal with the squat is to maintain fitness. Obviously, there's going to be an increase in the ability to squat bigger weights because we've been training it. There'll be some realization of those, you know, that of that progress early in the peaking phase. But once we've realized that strength, the squat takes a role of basically maintenance of the leg strength and the fitness in the legs. The volume can be used as a way to sort of maintain the training load while we're reducing the loading of the actual lifts themselves, so that you don't have a situation where you basically drop too much volume too quickly and the lifter loses fitness and loses skill. In most of the programs we've had, or most of the programs I've written, it's very rare that lifters PR their back squat the last week or so leading up to a competition, because in my mind, that situation would be not quite accurate, not quite specific enough, because the squat is a little bit slower. A one rep max squat does not necessarily indicate that you're in the best possible shape to do a one rep max snatch or one rep max clean and jerk.
And keep in mind with that, a lower qualified athlete is not going to be able to make that one rep max squat and one rep max clean and jerk simultaneously the same way that a less advanced, you know, if you've been doing weightlifting for a year, it's probably much more likely that the two happen. But if you're, you know, an A or B session lifter at nationals, the odds of that are less likely, and the need for it is less important, because you can't intensify everything at once. And this will hold true powerlifting or weightlifting. You know, if you're trying to build up your bench press, you're trying to hit the biggest one rep max bench press possible, it's probably not good in the same week to try and hit the biggest one rep max military press possible. You know, squat and deadlift, well, you got to do both of those. But, you know, back squat and front squat PRs in the same week or in the same short time period probably are unlikely. And the more and more advanced you become, the less likely they become. So that thought that my squat has to be at its absolute strongest, while simultaneously to the snatch and clean and jerk being at their absolute strongest, is probably a bit fallacious.
And even in my experience, from my experience, it has never been that the exact same moment in time your squat is at its absolute peak is also the same moment in time that your snatch and clean and jerk at their peak. And like we just explained, that's the way it should be. We want to have the highest performance in the lifts only. All else is secondary to that. So
as we get into, you know, and we're not going to talk the specific sets, reps, you know, it's because it's too big of a topic for this, and we have other videos on this, designing a peaking block video, particularly for powerlifting, as well as the phase potentiation video and the scientific principles we'll cover, and the principle of overload video, the numbers part of peaking training. But something I do want to talk about is the mental aspects of peaking, because you can do all the programming and physiological parts of the training, physical and physiological parts of the training, very, very well. And you can decay the fitness and you can, or sorry, you can decay the fatigue while keeping the fitness high, and then get to the competition and still fuck it up. So some of them, or you can derail, you know, 12 weeks of great work with a couple mistakes in the last week or in the taper process. And I think the first part of that is that you have to trust the process, because peaking training is very neurologically demanding. It is going to leave you with days where you feel very run down, where the weight feels very heavy. But if you are still able to lift that weight, it's all fine and it's all part of the plan. Because earlier in the peak, you don't have to feel great. You only have to feel great the day of. So if you can still make the weights while you feel beat up, that's good. Getting to the end of the peak and into the taper, you have to trust that you've set it up right. Because to be honest, at that point, you can't really do anything to change it. And the way that people do try and change it is, well, now I need to take one extra lift, you know, one extra big lift, because I haven't done enough, or I need to do this little bit of extra work. Because once the peaking training is done and the taper has begun, the work is done. Like, rest and recovery adaptive strategies are really all you have. All you have left at that time.
Interesting, too, because we know from our conversation with Andy Galpin that exposure is essentially the thing that's going to impact the change in physiology. So you can't just expose yourself to more rest. So you get to the taper week, and if you don't have the situation you want and you make the mistake of training harder or I'm going to figure this out and I'm going to fix my squat now, you can't fix that extra workload that's now fatigued you more by resting more. You just have a certain, you know, 5 days to the meet. That's what you get. So very much the case of trusting the process is huge in the peaking phase. It's basically, you know, it's mentally, that's the number one thing. For weightlifting, one of the things that's very easy for people to do, and on that same note, screwing things up, is excessive numbers of attempts or misses in the lifts. Because the skill is so critical in weightlifting, spending too much time attempting weights that you're missing, you're unsuccessful with, can lead to a kind of downturn in your confidence. If you've missed the last 6 or 7 or 8 heavy attempts at this PR that you've suddenly become obsessed with making, you know, 100 kilo snatch or 180 kilo snatch before the competition, and now you're clerking it in training, you're going to end up in a situation where at the meet you're not confident with that number. And it's a bad strategy to sort of chase that down. You have to be, you know, from my perspective in weightlifting, it's important to be psychologically ready and be on that positive side of things where you're not missing lifts. You've only ingrained the concept of success in your lifting, in your skill. And if that means being a little bit shy on the intensity side in weightlifting, that's exceptional, or that's a situation that's probably better off than being on the other side of that coin, which is failure after failure after failure and being doubtful, right?
Yeah, the mental part of the confidence part of peaking is huge. The confidence part of all the training, right, is huge. And yeah, to kind of wrap up that trust the process point, so much of that process and being able to be confident in, you know, maintaining fitness into the meet and having enough fatigue built up and fitness built up with that,
right,
that you can decay it properly. Again, it starts 12 weeks before. It starts at the beginning of general training, not the end of peaking. So kind of going right hand in hand with the idea of trusting the process is going to be something we call the discipline of rest. All right, that peaking training is not as hard as hypertrophy training. There are less reps, there are less sets. Yes, the weight is heavy, but doing one of them is, I think, easier, you know, for
it is for sure.
Yeah, semantics' sake, than doing 5 sets of 8 or the dreaded impossible 8 sets of 8.
8 sets of 8 is impossible.
Yes, no one has ever completed the 64
reps is the maximum. Everyone knows that.
Yeah. So the discipline of rest and getting to that time of the taper and not allowing yourself to try and go and do something extra, but putting in, you know, the work that's not hard to do. Contrast showers, ice baths, you know, massages and that kind of stuff, they're not hard to do. You know, even self-myofascial release, it depends, you know, who it is. the self-myofascial release, foam rolling, all that kind of stuff, it's not hard to do. Yeah, it takes some time, but it's not difficult and
right,
straining the way that 5 sets of 8, you know, squats at 70% are hard to do. But it is difficult to discipline yourself to do those little things that, as you get closer and closer to the meet, matter so much more.
Yeah.
The next one, and again, it's with that discipline of rest, is really just improve the recovery adaptive process. During the course of regular training, and the recovery adaptive process is so much, or should be so much, driven by the big two for recovery and adaptation: sleep and diet. While the other strategies, like, you know, temperature therapy, have their place, but most of that place is going to be in deload weeks, in restorative weeks. But when it gets time to compete, or if you're working with non-strength athletes, football players, basketball players, whatever, during the competition season, then all that matters is feel as good as I can.
Right.
So much of the adaptive process is done, and the recovery side of things becomes more and more important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, along with the discipline of rest and not going and doing those extra things, put your extra attention towards recovery adaptive strategies and enhancing that stuff.
Something on that is, as an athlete, if you want to become a better athlete, you need to be focused on, we always talk about process orientation, but you should be focused on doing the task in front of you to the best of your abilities. A lot of people, it's very easy to get into the mindset of, I'm going to go train really hard. You're a killer in the gym, but everything outside of that is just not interesting enough. It doesn't excite you enough. And like Chad's saying, a lot of these things are not, they're not flashy, they're not enjoyable or fun or anything really spectacular. They're not going to give you the same, you know, high from really pushing yourself. But as an athlete, it's important to develop the mindset of somebody who's trying to achieve something by, I'm going to attack this, you know, do extra ice baths or do extra recovery things. I'm going to go after those and pursue them with the same level of enthusiasm and the same level of commitment, let's say, to the process that I would if it was normal training, if it was 5 sets of 8 squat. You know, it's important to develop that mindset, especially, you know, for peaking.
Yeah. The peaking process, the taper process, is not a time for new stuff. And I see inexperienced lifters make this mistake all the time, whether it's a new exercise, it's some mechanical overloading strategy that they've never done before, but, you know, 10 days out, that's the time to try this supramaximal, you know, reverse band plus slingshot bench with 200% of my max.
Five board.
Yeah.
And the five board.
It's all the neural overload. You got to feel the weight. You got to feel it.
You got to feel it in your hands. Yeah. It's half the battle.
Yeah. Whether it's training stuff like that, whether it's new dietary or supplement decisions right before competition, and the closer and closer you get to competition, the less appropriate it is, because you don't know
right
how your body is going to respond to it. And though not everyone out there is a special snowflake, and you know their body's chemistry is different, they respond to things different, you know, some stuff just doesn't sit as well in certain people's stomachs as it does others. And the morning of competition may not be the time to try out that new pre-workout or that new superfood.
I think the general rule on if you're finding out if you're a special snowflake, if you have to ask, you're probably not a special snowflake.
Yeah, so the closer and closer you get to competition, the less new stuff you want to do. You don't want new variables,
right,
and you don't want new training stimulus, because new stimulus is greater fatigue than old stimulus. You know, something you've never done before is going to make you more sore or induce more fatigue than the things you've been doing over and over the last couple of weeks. For the mental part of competition, and as you mentally ready yourself for competition, I think people, they get there and they think they have to do something greater beyond themselves than they did in training to lift the weights. But the weights at meets weigh the same as the weights in training.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, depending on some,
yeah.
some clubs may possess fake weights. Who knows? If you have somebody helping you with the lift physically, then yeah, that's a little different. But yes, the weights always weigh the same.
Yeah, the weights in training weigh the same as they do at the meet. So you don't need to do something greater, you know, summon some mystical power to help you lift them. You just need to do the same stuff you've been doing day after day, week after week in training, but now you're doing it with less fatigue, but that same level of fitness and probably a higher level of arousal in competition than you had in training. So you'll have that little bit of extra push there from the adrenaline. You know, all the tens of people at the powerlifting meet watching you.
Tens.
but yeah, you'll have that extra adrenaline going, and you can use it to your advantage, particularly the more experienced you become.
That's something that, you know, that's a huge point, in that if your training is set up properly, if your peaking is set up properly, and the way you train is intelligent and strategic, you will not have exhausted the contrast between being really aroused in training and being aroused in a competition. If you're always training really, really hard and you're aroused in training too much, you're too excited, when you go to competition, that's not a new stimulus, and you can become even somewhat exhausted by the time you get there, and then you can't get aroused at the competition.
What's the most aroused you've ever seen a guy at a meet? That would be if someone just walks out singlet, fully tented.
That's probably. I wouldn't be surprised.
Don't worry, everyone. Just have a high arousal level. They talked about it on the Jug Life, so it's okay.
I'm extremely aroused right now. A lot of self-myofascial release going on earlier this week. But in all seriousness, it's true. If you're exhausting yourself in peaking, then you get to a competition, you have the intensity of the meet, the excitement is not there. It does not bring you to a new level.
Yeah, I've always thought it kind of goes with like a fight or flight response.
Right. Yeah.
Is the more frequently you're exposed to it, the less significant that hype you feel is, that adrenaline rush, you know. To the other side of the coin, if you've never felt it before, it the first time may be too overwhelming, and particularly in a more technical sport like weightlifting or when I was throwing, I couldn't get, and you know, I don't really get that fired up to do powerlifting stuff, but for throwing, you couldn't get fired up and tight because the tightness was slowness.
Yeah.
And the same idea for weightlifting. If trying to get so pumped up kind of throws the technique off, you're going to be pumped up already. You're going to be excited and you know, fired up without trying to be, just by the situation.
That's a lot to the art of programming and coaching, in that balancing those factors with each individual athlete. You know, does this person struggle in competition to get excited, to get, you know, turn it on and kind of embrace the adrenaline? Or is this person really timid in that situation? Do we have to practice this more? So,
yeah. And then the final kind of mental aspect of things in peaking and particularly at the competition is to control what you can control. Don't worry about what you can't.
Yeah.
As you're leading up to the meet, you're in peaking, you're in the tape or whatever it is, and you get on Instagram and you see your competition on there and you see that they did this weight and now, you know, you're changing your training. You're not trusting your process, the process you have laid out, you and your coach have laid out. That is a mistake. You know, you don't have to do 1 kilo more than them in training to do 1 kilo more than them in the meet. What you need to do is trust your process and let it work its way. If seeing them hit that heavy weight improves your discipline of rest, your attention to the details of recovery, adaptive strategies, that's great. But don't let it alter your plan in terms of doing extra sets or, you know, heavier weight than you have planned, because that's going to be to their advantage, not yours. And then when you get to the competition, there are very, very few factors that you get to control.
Yeah.
You know, you really control how good your preparation is, like how good a plan you make and how diligently you execute it. You don't get to pick what song's on. You don't get to pick if it's hot or cold. You know, if they don't have the bar that you like, if the sun shine in your eyes, you know, none
hashtag
of that stuff.
Powerlifting excuses.
you get to control how well you prepare. So how good of a plan you have, how diligently you execute that plan, and then how well you execute those exercises on the platform. And you know, if you press out, if you squat high, whatever it is, no one's else is making you do that.
Yeah. I think a big part of, and this is just a general thing, the process of training is that you can't go through a training cycle and change things halfway and then say the training cycle was poor, or you can't peak poorly and then change the entirety of the training process. It's important to learn how to evaluate how that was, look at the competition. Was it technical mistakes that you don't normally make? You know, did you squat high, but every squat in training was adequate, was good? You know, evaluate that and say, oh, it's maybe an error of my own. You know, I wasn't comfortable. I wasn't okay with how excited I got. And so you screwed it up. That's not really a training process error. It's just an error that you made that you need to correct next time. Or did you get to the meet and you were, you know, 20% weaker because you just trained poorly? So it's important that, you know, you take note of how the peak went, record your feelings, record how things were on the day of the meet, record what you did right and wrong technically, and then the physical side of things too, so you can evaluate it. Because many times it can be small, subtle changes that make or break the difference between a good training program and a good peak and a very poor one.
Yeah. Keeping a good training journal, keeping notes of as many factors as you can, really, without it becoming a compulsive issue.
I know a lady who maybe asks too many questions.
But that's sort of a big picture look at peaking, some of the differences between powerlifting and weightlifting. Hopefully, it helps you better inform your process of the last part of preparing for a meet. But remember, it starts at the beginning of the training cycle, not just at the beginning of peaking or the beginning of a taper. You're not saving a shit training cycle with a great taper.
Yeah.
But you definitely can fuck up a great training cycle with a bad taper. So take this advice into mind. Max, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram, Max_Ada, or on Facebook. You can look us up, or if you have any questions about the Juggernaut training program online or the one-on-one coaching through Juggernaut, you can email me, MaxJTSStrength, or check out
JuggernautCoaching.com.
Every time.
It's a pretty complex name, so I understand the issues.
I'm good with one Juggernaut.
We have clinics upcoming in the month of September. You will be
CrossFit Santa Barbara.
Yeah. And then you and Pomp will be in Rochester, New York.
Park Avenue.
Yes, CrossFit Park Avenue in early October. I'll be in Philadelphia giving – there's only room left in the lecture portion of things, programming lecture, at Warhorse Barbell on September 16th. And then in Minneapolis in late October, I believe October 28th, another programming lecture, though the practical hands-on part of things, again, is sold out. Beyond that, if you like the videos, subscribe to the channel. If you enjoy the podcast, please go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review. Spotify might have reviews too. I'm not actually sure yet.
I don't even know what that
is. Well, we're on it.
We're on Spotify?
We are.
We've made it.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal.
Okay.
Tell a friend about the Jug Life who would enjoy these sort of shenanigans and ramblings about some training stuff and being aroused.
Being aroused.
If they would like to become aroused by our training ramblings, tell them to check out the Jug Life. Thanks for watching. I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your newsfeed all day. He's Max Ada, at Max_AITA. That's it. See you next week.